Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal for their wonderful support. Now on with the show. Welcome to episode 99, where we will discuss a 1990 article by Joan Ocker titled Hierarchies, Jobs, Bodies, A Gendered Theory of Organizations, published in the journal Gender and Society. This is part one of the episode where we present Ocker's critique of organization studies and the elements of her proposed theory. To learn more about the text, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Hello, this is Tom calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States.
This is Sam calling from Mexico City.
And this is Pedro from California. And today I'm delighted to have with us Summer Jackson, who is an assistant professor of business administration in the Organizational Behavior Unit at Harvard Business School. Welcome, Summer.
Hi, thank you. Thanks so much for having me, calling in from Boston. Yes, my name is Summer Jackson, and I'm an assistant professor in the Organizational Behavior Unit, HBS. I'm a qualitative researcher, and I study organizational inequality. So I'm interested in the ways in which race, class, and gender are enacted in the workplace, and how organizations can create diverse, equitable, and inclusive workplaces where everybody can thrive.
Thank you. And so let's go right into the text. And indeed, this is one of our more recent classics, but it's definitely a classic. And this is Joan Ocker's Hierarchies, Jobs, Bodies, A Theory of Gendered Organizations. It was published in Gender and Society in June of 1990, which is kind of like at the front, the bow wave of the third wave of feminism, if my history is correct. And this is not just presenting a theory of gendered organizations. This is a critique of the organizational research that had come before, which included a number of feminist scholars from the past. So it's both commentary and a theoretical presentation. So Summer, would you like to introduce us to the text?
I'm excited to be talking with you all about this paper today. I was a feminist studies minor in undergrad, so this really brought me back. But some of the key things that I took away from Ocker's paper is in presenting this theory of gendered organizations, or as she calls it, the ways in which divisions of labor and symbols and signs, social structures and processes in organizations are in fact inherently gendered, she's pushing us beyond what previous scholars have been working on and looking at. In some ways, these previous scholars have assumed that these places are gender neutral. In other ways, they've tacked on gender after the fact. But what I really like about this paper is she starts to reveal and challenge the taken for granted assumptions that exist within a system or space. And she invites us to look at gender, but also other significant and salient social categories. And in doing this, she's arguing that organizations are not just gender neutral, but gender is in fact deeply embedded and mutually constitutive. And it's on us as researchers to look at these different jobs, tasks, hierarchies, and cultures that embed gender within them.
Okay, so, and I'd like to add that, to put this article in context, which is always important when we're discussing, what we're considering to be a classic. When I say the third wave of feminism, this is, I'd say, a time in which the conversations about gendered organizations or gendering in organizations was shifting from an emphasis on reform to a much more radical questioning or a critical thought. In the 1970s and 1980s, it was how do we integrate better, perhaps, was a little bit more of the conversation. But here, this is a bit more of a direct critique in saying that it's not just a matter of acknowledging that gendering exists and that we need to make incremental change, but this is calling for a complete revamping of what we mean by organization. And so the tone of the paper is much different than one might would have seen, say, in the 1970s and the 1980s.
And this reflects, I feel, in the way in which Joan Acker lays down her argument, right? Because she starts by saying that, you know, it's a fact of social life and organizational life that organizations have been dominated by men, or more precisely by masculinity. And then she tries to interrogate why is that organizational theory and our understandings about the economy at large have somehow evaded the question of why is such arrangement in place, right? Why the masculinity is taken for granted. But interestingly, as Tom is saying, unlike what previous theorists have done, she also has an indictment to previous feminist-oriented scholarship and critical scholarship in saying that this seems to operate in a world of add woman and steer, right? With this idea that it's just a matter of adding something to something that is understood as neutral. And she has an interesting conversation/critique with people like Rosabeth Moss-Kanter, which we have discussed in the podcast on episode 17, Ferguson, Reznor, right? And she's trying to articulate on how these theorists have pointed out that inequality is organized, but they have not gone far enough, so to speak, right? And I think that's exactly what we can unpack now, is what is that she proposes that we should go further from what these scholars have done.
Yes, Pedro. I think it's maybe worth for our listeners to mention some of the texts that Acker is engaging with and building on and talking to. Freeman's study in 1975 about the different ways in which the feminist movement kind of evolved into an organization and its interaction with either this idea of a more decentralized and fragmented organization or a more kind of formal bureaucratic one, which in this particular case was actually more successful in terms of survival. She, as you mentioned, engages with the work of Kanter as well and talking or reclaiming this point about how women are located at lower levels of the hierarchy. She also talks about the work of Felder and Glenn, who made a critique about how studies of work in organization usually just focus on men, whereas when we study women, we tend to study them more in terms of like family studies. The work of Ferguson in 1984 and this idea that, you know, Ferguson presents this critique of bureaucracy, a structure that does the same to people as society does to men in terms of taking away their power, making them dependent on the system. And she also mentions the work of Reznor, 1987, that talks about this dual structure in organizations, right? Bureaucracy and patriarchy and the effects that that has on inequality. And so she kind of engages with this text, and then she, you know, her big kind of entry point is making a critique and saying, we know all this, yet we still don't have a proper feminist theory on organizations.
I think I would also add that she includes, as kind of a rationale for putting this work out, a notion that if we do pursue a feminist theory, we would create organizations that are qualitatively different. So it's not just a matter of what should we know, but what should we do? And she makes an assertion, which we can revisit later, about the notion of that if we eliminate the gendering of organizations, they would become more democratic, more inclusive. I think first, though, we just kind of want to dive in, you know, some of the specifics of her argument. Because as you said, you know, she cites a lot of these previous works, and Moss-Kanter. I mean, the work that when we covered her in the episode, those were some pretty eye-opening studies at the time. You know, 1950s, when we were really trying to understand, you know, what was going on. And I guess the question I have is you know, was it really a matter of the earlier feminists failed to include this in their studies, or was it just a matter of there was just no way to pursue that kind of work before?
I mean, I'm curious to what Summer has to say, but I feel that the feminists were reacting to the reality that they were seeing, right? And Moss-Kanter in part shows that she has the whole idea of tokenism, because she was a clear fact that she was trying to articulate what it means to be in number terms different, right? And when the way you segregate people and you have a particular category in a sea of people that aren't like you, what it means and what kind of dynamics that create, right? And she was trying to articulate that because it was exactly the moment that women were segregated in particular occupations. She has these beautiful discussions about the work of secretaries versus the work of managers, right? And how they are, you know, segregating particular occupations and the extent they are part of the workplace. But like the feminist movement, I think the theorizing also comes in waves, because then Acker is trying to articulate that it's not just a matter in terms of difference of, you know, quantity, but it's a difference in kind, right? And that's exactly when she goes and lists the way in which this gendering happens, because there are divisions along gender lines in terms of division of space and power, the symbols and images that express, reinforce these divisions, the way in which the interactions reproduce the inequality on the turn-taking, who gets to speak, who gets to be listened to, the way in which people form and shape and understand their identities and see what they can be and the careers that they can attain. So that is, I think, what is she's trying to get at, is beyond this idea that there is something on top of or related to a particular difference that is general to how the way in which power is shared or not, or the ideas that what is an ideal worker, what kind of person can do such jobs, what kind of tasks mean and their values and how they are inscribed with particular values, depending on whether they are attributed as masculine or feminine traits and so on and so forth.
Yeah, one of the things that I took away when she's setting up, you know, why the need to consider gendered organizations is she does lay out sort of what we see and pay attention to as researchers and what gets rewarded in terms of published research sort of influences the available tools and repertoires that we as researchers have to build upon. So she's building off of that prior work and pushing us to really consider the ways in which organizational practices can maintain or destabilize the status quo. And she takes into account, I think, how previous research may have been limited in different ways, and in that way, subsequently limited the types of tools and repertoires that researchers have had.
Yeah, just to go back to Tom's kind of question of, is she claiming that these previous work have failed? I don't think she does. I think she, and I identify at least three critiques. You guys will tell me if you see any others, but to these texts that have said, you know, these structures are gender, but then stop there, she kind of makes the invitation of, we need to go beyond the critique and we need to actually propose what a feminist organization would look like in terms of structure. You know, she kind of talks to these bodies of work that have exposed how structures are gender and they're discriminatory, but then stop there. And so she kind of wants to push that type of work to offer an alternative in terms of what a feminist organization would look like. And then she also talks to people that are doing critical organization theory. And there the critique is more, you know, there's a lot of talk about power and these other types of concepts, but it's still very much focused on the male experience and not, it doesn't incorporate gender. And then the third critique that I identified is, you know, even in cases where we're studying gender discrimination, it's kind of framed or it seems like it's talking about bad individuals as opposed to actually the structures that allow for these things to happen. And then the clear case is how we used to study sexual harassment, right? In terms of, oh, this happens and it does, like, as if it's separate from the structure that allowed it to happen. So those are the three critiques that I think she makes. I don't know if you guys identified any others. But I don't think that necessarily means that she's, you know, attacking previous work, just saying, given that we have these things, we need to move forward. We need to actually provide a feminist theory of organizations.
And what is such theory, right? And that's when she makes the shift and tries to understand or reconsider the very notion of a job, which is foundational to our understanding of organizations, right? Because she's going on to understand how this idea that, you know, there is a job that is separate from the person, which is the boxes in the organizational chart, so to speak, and what do we attribute in terms of what such jobs mean and how the very way in which they are constructed, they have encoded in them some gendered ideas.
And moreover, the language that, you know, I want to get into what do we think she means by gender neutral when she starts describing bureaucracy, when she describes jobs. But the term I recall seeing in there quite a bit was disembodied. It's in a way, it's not just a matter of of trying to remove gender from the conversation, but just about all aspects of humanity from the conversation. So the job is a space that could be occupied, and she's very critical about the idea that the space could be occupied by an interchangeable person, in effect. And that very disembodiment, ostensibly, it's in order to allow things like some flexibility in the organization to be able to do whatever its mission is. It has the effect of dehumanizing, and in particular with genderdom, it sort of denies both the role of gender and the role of sexuality in how the organization shapes that. In one breath, you know, bureaucracy is supposed to help us with making things reliable, making things predictable and stable. On the other hand, it's suppressing all notions of humanity from the discourse on organization. And I think that's kind of what I was taking away is her critique of organization to that point.
I see, yes, and I see even an earlier one, which I have to say that have never occurred to me, even though I'm very interested in organizational structure and organizational forms, because she starts by saying that when we think about jobs and hierarchies, right, we assume a congruence between a job, the place in the hierarchy, and the responsibility that such job comes with. And she starts to question some of that. And she has a very interesting, you know, observation on how, for example, women occupy positions that are low in the hierarchy, and then assume to be, you know, doing jobs that are not complex of little consequence. And she gives the example of someone, you know, with child caring responsibility, right? Or also the case of the secretary, that gives the example of dealing with six different temperamental bosses, which is a task with a good level of complexity and responsibility, but because it's positioned in the hierarchy under the manager, so to speak, then is understood as one that automatically is not as complex, has not as many responsibility, and therefore should be compensated accordingly, both monetarily and symbolically, right? So there is this interesting thing that even something that seems so innocuous as this assumption that, yes, of course, where you're placed in the hierarchy means to deal with the complexity and so on, but because the way these things are constructed are gendered, where some positions are put literally, then, are actually an effect, not a cause, of the gendering. And therefore, they're put there because it's the idea that such kind of work is not as complex and relevant as the others, right?
Yeah, I think that's a really important nuance and insight that she brings, right? So exactly building off what you said, Pedro, sometimes it's the tasks that are feminized and therefore devalued. But she also shows in ways in which when women enter into occupations or professions that were previously higher status or higher valued or higher up in the hierarchy, by nature of having a female gendered body in that role, they then become devalued, right? And so then this clerical work becomes less valued. And now it is in the lower ranks of the organizational hierarchy. So it's both like a constitution of the task and also the person occupying the role, and then they start to mutually reinforce each other. The levels of analysis that she pushes us to bring to our research, I think it's why we have so many great papers today, but it all came from sort of the way in which she unpacked gender in organizations in this paper and gendered organizations.
I agree. And I think I would add a third one, which, I mean, that's how we take this text a lot in public administration, which is the ideas that we have, for example, in this case of public administration, of the public manager, or even in private organizations, you know, the ideas that you have of what a good manager or a good leader is, and how those ideas are already gendered, which causes, even if women do get to occupy those spaces, then, you know, they're either forced to change their leadership style or their working style to appeal to those kind of expectations, or they are judged and their work is valued less, or they are perceived to be not as good workers because they don't fulfill that expectation.
I think that's when she brings here the whole dimension of what organizations erase, right? Or how the way they are built kind of depends on this ecosystem that is assumed to not be relevant, or the care work that, you know, has to place, because she has this interesting comment in showing that this ideal man can go through life in such a way because there is people caring for all in life that is not part of such idealized professional. And traditionally, in those moments, and still today to an extent, there is, you know, the idea that the manager was the man. And Razabeth talks about that, right? That there was the wives, and she talks about the wives in the book, that it was part of the division of work, was just like invisible. And again, it's the same thing. So there is this idealized view of to be a worker, in this case, someone that has no ties, that is independent, because all of the ties and the responsibilities beyond the workplace are taken care of by someone else.
This is where, you know, the focus for this article has been on organizations. Of course, societies surrounding the organizations play a part in this too. And, you know, so it sort of brings in somewhat of a chicken and egg kind of a question. Is the organization reflecting society, or is society also reflecting the organizations? I bring that up because, you know, when we look at the what happened in the early days of the pandemic, you know, you have organizations that have been trying to be more inclusive, be more equal from a gender perspective, who under pressure from the pandemic reverted. And I think there was some studies done in Iceland and some other European countries that specifically looked at that and say, you know, so it sort of shows that, you know, how deeply embedded this gendering in the organization is, that despite so much progress being done over so many years, the first sign of, or under a sign of significant stress, it immediately snapped back.
I think that question about, is it society influencing organizations or organizations influencing society? To that exact point about the pandemic, I have a colleague, Alexander Feldberg, who has been working on some research following people through COVID. And I think it's very like relevant to the conversation we're having now, because we've been talking about how roles are structured in gendered ways and how tasks are structured in gendered ways. And then you have this gendered body like enacting the role and the tasks. And basically, one of the things that she's found is that even for the same role and the same set of tasks, men and women are structuring their interpretation of it differently. And so during the pandemic, women said like, well, my job is more flexible. But she has this massive data set of like people with similar jobs, similar roles, similar tasks. And it turns out the women are interpreting their jobs more flexible so they can help with childcare. But a man with the exact same role and tasks is not interpreting their role that way. And therefore it then falls to their partner to help with the childcare during the pandemic. So I think, you know, Acker's work continues. And the ways in which gendered organizations are enacted continues.
It's interesting. I was just rereading Weber the last night for a different thing and thinking about how he goes to lengths to explain relationships, and both sides of any relationship. He's talking about power and so on depends on both parties latching on a shared understanding, right? That's basically also sociology after Weber, on how social structures depend on people understanding them in such ways, in this case, the roles, so then they get reproduced, right? So it's not just that they have been gendered one off and then it goes, but they're continually being maintained because we continually understand our own or each other's tasks, in this case, under a particular framework, right? That is given to us, to go back to what you're saying, similar to the signs and symbols that pervade our life at work and beyond. And another mechanism, I think, that just says a little bit in between the lines of how the structure of jobs and then hierarchy and accenting which bodies fit or not fit there reproduced gender inequality and beyond is also, I thought, interesting. I have never thought of that again, is to some extent how some tasks are delegated by someone else, but they still continue to be understood as a responsibility of another person. And she was given the case of secretaries again, that they have sometimes many tasks that are delegated to them from managers, but they're not understood as being their full responsibility, right? Even though they're the ones practically carrying them out. And that's, I think, another way of maintaining these inequalities, right? Is that the real work is done by someone, but is still understood maybe by the person doing that, but certainly for the one that has assigned, because of the managers, as actually being within this person's responsibility and purview. So part of such job, even though it's technically done by someone else. So all of this roundabout to say is not just that people understand their tasks in a particular way, but they also may attribute or misattribute some work to themselves, even though it's actually, you know, carried out by someone else.
I once wrote a paper on ghostwriting. Is that kind of like an example? This may be a good segue to something that I wanted to address, because some of the things that we are talking about don't just, you know, they're gendered, but they're also, there are other ways in which, say, minorities or those who are not in power are marginalized. So it's like in this particular case, we're talking about, someone who is junior in rank. So I served as a ghostwriter to somebody very, very senior for a while. Now, the relationship was understood because the one who had the ideas or had the experiences that were put onto paper were owned by the senior person, but I, as the ghostwriter, had the responsibility to devote the time necessary to put it into coherent language. So it was a glorified secretary, I suppose. But it's a similar phenomenon in that there's different ways in which, you know, say those who are in power relate to those who are not in power. But in my particular case that I'm offering, it is not systemic anywhere near to the same degree. So, for example, you know, somebody in my position would could very well elevate to assume the senior level at some point in the future if I chose to do so or if I was chosen to do so. Whereas in this particular case, we're talking about a system that really keeps a ceiling on things, that restricts mobility and kind of makes these relationships as a bit more of a permanent arrangement. Is that a fair assessment?
So I think the other, and that's towards the closing of the paper, I think, aspect that Acker goes, because as we said, she starts with this idea that it's a fact that organizations are dominated by men and wonders how come org theory has not dealt with that, and then brings the previous feminist theorizing and examines and tries to go further. It talks about the different ways gendering happens. And then the big bulk of the paper, I think the new idea is this whole idea of how jobs are defined and the bias that goes into them, we may say, right? So how they reproduce mechanisms of gendering. But then she talks about sexuality and reproduction and forms of control and tacit control and overt control, right? And hegemonic masculinity, which are all of the things that I think Sam was saying before. So maybe we can reflect a little bit on that.
Yeah, thanks, Pedro. I'll take a first stab, because this, I think, is where you really do have a big difference between the problem of gendering and the problem faced with other areas of difference. There is a biological basis, and how you deal with that has been the longstanding approach. I think we were talking before about, you know, the difference in, you know, male and female roles in various societies. This is where it becomes manifest. And it's a tough nut to crack, because I know that since this article has been written, there have been various efforts, very explicit efforts, like say in my country, where we used to have maternity leave, now we have paternity leave. We're trying to make things equitable in different ways through policies, through various practices or whatever. But it still comes out simply different, because the sexuality, I mean, the experience of being a mother is understood to be different from being a father. And then you also have those who are neither mother nor father, or have not had children. The bureaucracy is, of course, trying to make things fair and equitable and just for everybody across the board. But there's this one phenomenon of childbirth that ultimately is unequal. And how do you make it? I don't want to say how do you make it equal. That's not the right way to put it. But how do you make it fair, or come up with a fair process that treats everybody equally, if not the same, is really, really difficult. Because just about anything you do still runs up against this, just the biological fact.
Yeah, I think something I really like about this paper, in terms of how it helps us understand and think about and study organizations, is that it introduces all these new elements that maybe before we didn't used to think were actually relevant things to study in organizations. So sexuality is a very clear example, but there's also, you know, she talks about exploitation, emotion, identity, you know, as additional to all the other things that we used to study and think about when we think of organizations, which are, you know, control, action, meaning, like, so she introduces all these new variables and then pushes you to think, this is also part of the organization. And these, the same as the other stuff that we used to study, is also typified, right? It's everything has a masculine and feminine element, and then people are kind of judged and placed according to how we make distinctions across all these categories, even if we don't talk about them, even if we don't talk about identity and emotion and all these things. And I'm thinking about, you know, when the time around the time that this paper was written, even if we don't talk about these things, they still exist and they're very powerful in terms of situating people and assessing how much themselves and their work are worth.
Yeah, I feel like to Tom's question, something that I saw coming out towards the end of the paper with this concept of hegemonic masculinity, which is not explored in depth here. And I understand why, because she's putting forward an argument around the ways in which gender interpreted to mean women has been overlooked within organizations. But there's certainly an element in which hegemonic masculinity and this ideal worker norm is obviously negative for men as well, right? The idea that you are this detached human, you know, the ways in which these jobs have been gendered is a negative thing for men who want to have a fulfilling work-life balance and participate in their family lives and things like that. And so you see that being carried out in research that's being done now. But she's sort of, you know, what's useful about Acker's exploration of hegemonic masculinity in this paper is it starts to lay the groundwork for ways of thinking which how these things are gendered is not just a problem for women, it's also a problem for men. And future research then begins to explore the ways in which it's a problem for men. But exactly to your point, Tom, about what do we do about parental leave? Well, both parents should be able to participate in the child rearing and other, you know, child rearing and fun elements of being a parent, right? It shouldn't be that women have birthing parents have like a disproportionate burden of the tasks because the ways in which organizations are gendered makes it difficult for them to participate, because by excluding one and being overly reliant on the inclusion of another, you're actually discriminating and especially for all parties when you're only optimizing for one type of person's participation, I guess is what I take away from her paper.
This conversation has made me think, I had not thought about that when I read the paper, that's why the conversation is so great, is that we are describing through Acker a form of externality that I think we have been unsensitized because organizations were built in somehow effacing, hiding, I don't know, like pushing under the rug type of situation, the extent in which they have a spillover in society, as we were saying, right? But also they assume that there is conditions that allow them to function. And this form of externality is one in which such fundamental aspect of life, you don't even have to have markers, social life, organizational life, just life, is reproduction, right? And all of that, and care. But organizations are built with the assumption that none of this is part of their purview, even though everyone is involved in such tasks. And, you know, even if you don't have kids, I would say that care at large is something that everyone participates because we are all interconnected. We are born from someone and we have people around us. So care has many forms, but it's kind of, it's hidden or it's programmatically excluded, right? And as much as I'm a fan of understanding the good sides of bureaucratic administration and the way it brings impartiality and fairness, historically has been a mechanism for that to some extent, it is true that all of these assumptions have within them to operate this idea there must be people that are doing such work, there must be spaces on this is happening that, you know, if you want to think in a positive way, it's just because in an ideal society, this would be divided in a way that's not an issue for organizations. That would be things that are addressed at the social level. But as we know, because organizations pervade our life and societies, meaning the state itself is an organization, right? It's important to understand how all of these things take place, right? Because the very idea that goes into a policymaking process and the way in which there is idealized versions of to whom the policy should cover or not, it's not immune to all of that as well.
Yes, and I think she does mention it, and I think this is something maybe Tom mentioned at the beginning, and maybe we can discuss more in part two. But I mean, she shows, you know, the effects on women. She shows also the effects on men, but she also talks about how a feminist project for organizations would help make them more democratic and support the achievement of more humane and social goals. So I think that's interesting because it talks not just, it doesn't stay just at the level of within the organization and how that impacts people that are inhabiting the organization, but also what kinds of organizations do we have? What effects does that have on society, and what kinds of goals and what kinds of things are we achieving with these organizations, but having them structured the way they are, and what they could achieve if we were to structure them differently.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. And if so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.